hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. If you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought-and-died. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side me, running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought-and-died key. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
It's rash when you're running down my country. You're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, Monday I was in Regina. In fact, I've been in six cities in 6 days. On Sunday, of course, I had a meeting in my hometown of Hamilton, Ontario. Monday, I was in Regina. Tuesday, I was in Calgary. Wednesday, I was in Edmonton. And Thursday and Friday, I'm in Vancouver. So, no rest for the wicked. Let me see. Now, when I was in Regina, on my way in from the airport, I happened to see an election sign for an NDP candidate. And let's see, what was his name? Oh, do we have it here? Perhaps not. Jigger. Yeah, his name is Jigger. Running for the NDP. Jigger. Yeah, you know, Canadians will vote for that, or I'm afraid will vote for anything. So, okay, old Jigger's running for the NDP. That's, of course, not the most interesting, or by any means the most important news of the week. Big things happening in my hometown of Hamilton today. Yep, it turns out that the anti-racists are in full holler, full agitation. Maxime Bernier has been scheduled to speak at Mohawk College on Sunday. Now this has the all the anti-free speech people in a state of near apoplexy. And Evan Balgord, he's the executive director of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, which describes itself as a non-profit monitoring, exposing, and countering hate groups in Canada. No, the Canadian Anti-Hate Network is not anti-hate, it's anti-white, and it's fundamentally anti-free speech. So he wrote a fiery opinion piece for the very complicit Hamilton Expectorator, Spectator. Mohawk College should have declined to rent space to Maxime Bernier. On September 29th, Hamilton's Mohawk College plans to rent space to People's Party of Canada leader Maxime Bernier and YouTube personality Dave Rubin. Hamilton is a front line of hate group versus anti-racist and anti-fascist action in Canada, and the PPC's decision to have the event at Mohawk during the election is deliberate. Well, yeah, they'd like to draw many of the people who have been dispossessed and unrepresented in these communities for decades. Many in their base hate anti-racists and anti-fascists and share fantasies of fighting them and watching them be arrested. Yeah, but they should be arrested in many cases because they're violent. They wear masks. That's contrary to the criminal code unless you're at a masquerade party or going out on Halloween. Hate anti-racists? I don't know about hate anti-racists, but these anti-racists are out there and in your face and always trying to restrict free discussion and free speech. Yeah, many of Maxime's supporters and our supporters feel exactly the same way. Okay, the question is, why is Mohawk playing along? What do you mean playing along? They rent space. President Ron McCurley said on Twitter, all colleges and universities are covered by government-mandated freedom of speech policy that requires us to provide opportunity for anyone to express their views. My God, really? Oh, my. What intrusion. Well, that is thanks to Premier Doug Ford, who has passed legislation that requires tax-funded colleges and universities to protect free speech. Gosh darn, isn't that an awful intrusion? No. Colleges over the past 20 years have egregiously failed to protect free speech. In some cases, they banned right-to-life groups. They have behaved appallingly. The very places where you would expect free speech to prevail, open discussion, you know, like universities. No. They, in many cases, they become petty, tight, Maoist little bastions of cultural Marxism. So the poor old president of Mohawk says, well, all colleges and universities are covered by government-mandated freedom of speech policy that requires us to provide opportunity for anyone to express their views. Well, right, and that's as it should be. The government policy requires that they don't obstruct or interfere with the freedom of speech of others to express their views. Nowhere does it say that Mohawk is required to rent to anyone, says Evan Balgord, this anti-free speech operative. Well, he's just wrong. Mohawk College, it says, respects the right to freedom of expression and will comply with the Ontario Human Rights Code. Mohawk College reserves the right to ensure that any use of facilities does not compromise Mohawk College or the college's community activities, as well as the safety and security of persons and facilities. And you begin to see a weasel clause there. Well, as a matter of fact, Mohawk College then said because of security concerns, it was going to require 10 times the security costs that it originally required. And TV YouTube personality Dave Rubin said, okay, out of my own pocket, I'll pay that. Now that's extortion. And it really is extortion. This is being the gambit that some universities hating free speech or hating dissent have used. Well, we need more money for security. So some, like one college group at Wilfrid Laurier University, headed by one of the free speech activists, had invited in a hardcore immigration critic. This was when it was run by Lindsay Peterson, Lindsay Shepherd, rather. Got the name wrong. Anyway, it went from a couple hundred dollars to about $4,000 or $5,000. Well, a student group isn't able to afford that, and that's the reason. You say that, so the colleges will say, "Well, of course, we'll let you have a speaker there if you provide some money for security." Oh no, because the Antifa are promising a protest, you'll have to provide $4,000 or $5,000. No, that's basically allowing the threatmeisters and the terrorists to price free speech for dissidents, nationalists, patriots, free speechers out of possibility. And here's what ought to be done. If there are threats made, and if the campus security at the college or university feels that they can't handle it, what should they do? This is a tough one. Wait a sec, what's that she said? Call the police? Yeah, right, call the police. It's a police matter. If somebody is threatening, if they say, if we don't get our way, we are going to bust up the affair or close it down or pull the fire alarms, as they sometimes do, you bring in the police. The police should be pulled off their useless revenuing, hiding behind their photo, their radar, just revenuing and harassing motorists, and do what they really ought to be doing, and that's protecting citizens from threats. So if a group like the masked Antifa make threats that they're going to try to shut this down or disrupt it or whatever, then the police should be called and the police should attend. And if there are any attempts to disrupt the event or prevent people from attending, then the police should intervene. It's all that simple. Anyway, going back to Evan Balgord. Now, Evan Balgord, of course, is an operative of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. That's, of course, Canadian Anti-Free Speech Network, Canadian Anti-White Network. Let's see, he goes on to complain somewhat further. So many PPC supporters and organizers have been exposed as bigots, members of, or supporters of hate groups. Lie. No member, to my knowledge, has been a part of any group convicted of willfully promoting hatred against any of the privileged minorities in Canada. This is a lie. Radical conspiracy theorists are full-blown neo-Nazis, and it's hard to keep count, says Evan Balgord. Well, I don't know anybody who supports the People's Party of Canada, including myself, who would call himself a neo-Nazi. That's a term of smear and abuse by Evan Balgord. These are people who were excited about Bernier's anti-multicultural message and got it in on the ground floor of the PPC. Dave Rubin, he's the host of the event, is a far-right YouTube personality and a significant part of a radicalization process ushering people into the neo-Nazi movement, according to a recently published study of Cornell University. What I'd like to know is, does Dave Rubin say, "I'm trying to usher people into a neo-Nazi movement"? My strong feeling is he does not. Evan Balgord goes on to say, either would be counter-demonstrated in Hamilton, and with the current environment, it promises to be tense. Mohawk can expect anti-racists to show up and their own students to demonstrate. They can also expect members of hate groups from around Ontario to come, including militant groups like the Soldiers of Odin and the Northern Guard, assault some by supporters of far-right groups are commonplace at these demonstrations. Au contraire, at some of the confrontations at Yellow Vest events, the aggressors have always been the Antifa. But even if all this were true, doesn't matter whether neo-Nazis, racists, blah, 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 they've got a right to assemble and to hear Maxime Bernier. And Evan Balgord continues, Hamilton has become a front line of hate group activity because their supporters believe the Hamilton police approve of their demonstrations. They think they will be treated with kid gloves by police. Now Hamilton's reputation as a battlefield has drawn the People's Party of Canada. Anyway, they go on to, he goes on to conclude that the space should be denied to the People's Party of Canada. And you know, that of course is always the bottom line of the anti-hate groups. You know, they don't want a discussion. They don't want a discussion. They don't want a debate. I'll tell you why. Because they know they'll lose. They're not in this to have a discussion or have a debate where society hashes out fundamental differences. You know, we don't all see eye to eye on everything. Fair enough. In a civilized society, both factions and others, you know, it's not just A or B, get a chance to present their piece, their views, make their arguments, and intelligent people decide. But no, in the world of cultural Marxism, there's only one point of view. All others must be silenced or crushed. You either get with the agenda and agree with them, or submit to being to being crushed, and simply you know, go away. Well, we're not going away. So it looks as though Sunday's going to be a very interesting day in Hamilton, in my hometown. Well, today, and I want to thank people who kind of have my back for me. I mean, I can't always watch everything you know, on the internet. I have a very busy speaking schedule and many other commitments, so I really appreciate people who keep an eye out for me and from time to time say, well, you know, have you seen this? It involves you. And, you know, sometimes I have not seen this, whatever it might be. So this was brought to my attention. And one of the great things about this is that this appeared online actually considerably before it appeared in in print. And this was an article, or an opinion piece, I guess, in Thursday's Hamilton Spectator, and it was an opinion piece written by, by a Jeff Mahoney. I'm going to read the opinion piece, and I'm going to read my response. Choir raises mighty voice against hate at Hamilton City Hall from groups like Soldiers of Odin. Anna Wilson was becoming increasingly alarmed at the threatening and abusive ways of hate groups in City Hall gatherings. She turned to the collective power of song and music. So was born the Love and the Hammer Choir. Now, note in that kind of introductory teaser, this Anna Wilson was alarmed by the abusive ways of hate groups at City Hall gatherings. Now, you always have to remember, that is a loaded, defamatory accusation. Hate. Hate in Canada is a very carefully defined term. It is violation of Section 319 of the Criminal Code, and that prohibits willfully promoting hatred against privileged groups, you know, race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, sexual identity, handicap, etc. Now, just because a group has a strong stand on immigration doesn't mean it's a hate group. To be labeled as a hate group, it would have to have been charged, prosecuted, a trial held, defenses raised, and then convicted. And then and only then can you call it a hate group. Well, there's no such hate group in Hamilton. Anyway, the article goes on. How does that saying go? All it takes for hatred to thrive is for good people to not show up at Hamilton City Hall on Saturdays and oppose bigotry by singing out their love louder than loathing. Well, I heard them two Saturdays ago, and these are, I would say, rather hippy-dippy, mostly women, they've got the right to sing their silly inclusion songs, but okay. Fortunately for this city, there's no chance of people like Anna Wilson and Nicole Smith not showing up. Not as long as there are hate buses climbing the curb, white supremacists like Paul Frum spewing garbage on the forecourt, yellow vesters blocking light, or the soldiers of Odin generally trying to intimidate. One libel after another. Hate buses. Okay. Did the bus bringing people pro-free speeches from out of town call themselves we're a hate bus? No, they didn't. That's a lie told about them. Supremacists like Paul Frum spewing garbage on the forecourt. That's in front of Hamilton City Hall. Well, I am not a white supremacist. I am a white nationalist. There's a huge difference. A white nationalist is proud of his people, the European founding settler people of this country, and I don't want them replaced. A supremacist wants to rule over others. There's a big diff. Spewing garbage. I was spewing garbage on... Well, actually, I never made a speech in the several protests I've attended. I've given a couple of interviews, and I have held my good old red ensign flag, the flag of the real Canada, but I have not made a speech, so I haven't been spewing anything, garbage or otherwise. Yellow vesters blocking light, God knows what that means. But they block the sun? Not likely. And soldiers of Odin generally trying to intimidate. What, by their very presence? Well, you know, if you live in a snowflake nation, I suppose almost anything might be a bit intimidating. And not as long as Maxime Bernier gets scheduled to appear at Mohawk College. The Love and the Hammer Choir will be there too at Mohawk College, singing in countermeasure. They will be singing as they do songs of acceptance, affirmation, and protest. Acceptance of white nationalists? Don't think so. Songs like Lead with Love and Resilience from the Justice Choir songbook. They'll be singing to expose, by contrast to their music and informed voices, the utter noise, nonsense, and disgusting drivel that passes for free speech among the far right and hate groups. Expose it for what it is, hate groups. Once again, the libel. Never charged, never convicted of this. That's like saying your dad is a mass murderer. But never being charged with anything, never being convicted, you can't say that. Now, this is an opinion column, so I guess he's entitled to his opinion, but it's a rant. Quote, not a 100 feet from me, this school bus driven by a yellow vest supporter wearing military fatigues was driven up onto City Hall forecourt toward a crowd of residents celebrating diversity, she recalls. It was like it was happening in slow motion. Yeah, but didn't the bus hit anybody? No. It's all drama. Frustrated at the challenge of channeling the feelings and anxieties produced by the confrontational nature of what was happening at the rallies, Wilson hit on the idea, collective song. And so started the Love and the Hammer Choir. They've been meeting and singing at the rallies every Saturday since late August, and their popularity is growing. A way to sing back at the fear. Fear what? People with a different opinion. Peacefully demonstrating.
and the fear is there. And after the hate bus, there were the soldiers of Odin and Fromm. No, that's me. Yeah, I appeared two Saturdays ago. Ooh, scary. People who aren't at City Hall at the Saturdays anti-hate rallies often don't see how bad the fascists are, says Wilson.
Oh, I see. We're fascists. What does she mean by that? Has she asked any of the participants? And I know some of these Yellow Vest people. They're fairly naive and they're fresh to politics. They're not followers of Benito Mussolini, and that's what fascism is. Good or bad, and I'm not knocking fascism. I think it was a very good doctrine. It had a place, it had a time. But none of these people would say, oh, I'm a fascist. Quote, no one feels safe, agrees choir member and community advocate Nicole Smith. They, the haters, use dog whistle tactics, outward shows of patriotism, like wearing seemingly innocent I'm a Canadian t-shirts to create a semblance of normalcy, but then sow conflict, hatred, and aggressiveness at the gatherings. Okay, so what's she saying? No one feels safe.
Well, I can't speak to that. I mean, I can't be responsible for the emotions of snowflakes or people who perhaps are quite frankly mentally disturbed. That's the haters. The columnist doesn't even try to be objective. So that's the people who are opposed to illegal immigration, to the carbon tax, etc. Use dog whistle tactics.
What does that mean? Well, you say one thing, but you mean another. So, okay, when we say proudly Canadian, we mean something else? Well, we're proudly Chinese?
When we say we don't want a carbon tax, we what? Want to incinerate the planet? Dog whistle tactics is nonsense. Outward shows of patriotism. Well, they appear to be patriotic, but they're not really patriotic. They're something else. And let's see. And so the people who are protesting, rallying, or simply celebrating diversity have been joining in the singing, adding their voices to the swell. Some are too shy or uncomfortable to join the chorus.
Well, if they're that fragile, why don't they just go back into their plastic bubble?
But nonetheless, express their support and thumbs up for the positive feelings the singing brings to the weekly gatherings. How do we respond to the meat grinder of horrible ideas and behaviors of the hate groups? Once again, that libel, asks Smith. Is there another vision aside from direct confrontation? So, okay, they come out and say,
hey, I don't have any problem with them coming out and singing. They've got the same right to protest as we do.
Puffery. Okay, now this is my letter to the slandering, lying, smearing Jeff Mahoney, who wrote this. And I entitled this, Reply to a Lying, Libelous Smear Piece in the Hamilton Spectator Demonizing Immigration Reform Protesters, and yours truly. Your smear piece, Choir Raises Mighty Voice Against Hate at Hamilton City Hall, from groups like Soldiers of Odin in today's Spectator, as regards me, is fake news and a lie. So I'm not gonna fudge it. That's what it is. I have corrected the expectorator. That's my nickname for the Hamilton Spectator. Expectoration is, of course, spitting. As far as I'm concerned, that paper isn't worth a bubble of warm gob on the sidewalk. I'm a white nationalist, I say, not a white supremacist. There's a difference. In your puff piece about Anna Wilson, with utterly shoddy journalism, you didn't interview the people she defames with labels like haters and fascists. And that's right. Utterly crap propaganda journalism. It isn't journalism, it's just a rant. Before calling me all these names, Jeff Mahoney never spoke to me. And to my best of my knowledge, he never spoke to the Yellow Vests. In one sentence, you proclaim, not as long as there are hate buses climbing the curb, white supremacists like Paul Fromm spewing garbage on the forecourt. I doubt the bus called itself a hate bus. I have never spoken on the forecourt, and thus haven't spewed garbage or anything else. It isn't even clear whether the torrent of abuse are your words or Anna Wilson's. Our opposition to our country's immigration policies is not hate. Calling the Yellow Vests and Soldiers of Odin hate groups is a lie and a libel. To the best of my knowledge, neither has ever been charged under Section 319 of the Criminal Code, that's willful promotion of hate against privileged groups, let alone convicted. They are not hate groups. Some people like Anna Wilson or you may hate their political views, but that doesn't make these people, myself included, hate groups. Your article demonizes good, concerned citizens. I have no problem with Anna Wilson and her friends singing to promote their vision of society. Certainly, the same respect should be accorded to those with other perspectives. I, for instance, expose the injustice of precious spaces in our homeless shelters being given to illegals, while Canadian-born citizens huddled in lean-tos and tents last year along Hamilton's railway tracks. This is love, not hate. Love for our own people. Your article is inflammatory. In my few visits to the weekly Saturday protest, the only hate I've seen is masked cowards of Antifa shoving an elderly protester and ripping her sign, and several Antifa smashing at the back of my car. This was captured on video. Sincerely, Paul Fromm. And that's posted on our website. That's CAFE. That's Canadian Association for Free Expression. You might want to check it out. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Well, I left today from Edmonton, Alberta, and as my shuttle approached the airport, there was a gas station, and gasoline was 97 cents a liter. For the price in dollars multiplied by 4, so that would be about $3.80 a gallon. That's still a lot. That's a lot by American standards, but it's cheap in Canada. So I get to Vancouver, and here I am in North Vancouver, and I'm walking for some exercise, and I see a gas station. This is not an aberration. I saw the gas stations with pretty much the same price. Gasoline's $1.45 a liter. 97 cents in next door province of Alberta, $1.45 in British Columbia. Almost 50% more. Why? Well, it's an ugly combination of enviro lunatic carbon taxes, additional taxes, and greedy gasoline companies that simply rip the customer off. Gasoline is extraordinarily expensive here in Vancouver, a little less expensive in the interior. Why? Several factors, but one of them being gas company greed. Now, if there ever was an issue for a populist politician to go after, that's this. And some of this is a result of the catastrophic car-hating policies of the Greens and the Socialist NDP, but also to some extent the provincial Liberals, because guess who brought in the carbon tax? That's right, the Liberals, under a previous regime. It is suicidal. Now, I've noticed that food prices here in British Columbia are very, very high. British Columbia is 2,000 miles closer to one of the main sources of fruit and vegetables. That's California and a little bit further south, Mexico. 2,000 miles closer than where I live in Hamilton, Ontario, or roughly speaking, Toronto. Well, how can that be? Well, one of the reasons is transportation costs. Brought on by, you guessed it, the carbon tax. So the lunatic carbon tax hurts us at every level. Here was a very interesting opinion piece by an author that appeared a couple of days ago in the Globe and Mail. And it was about a couple of the hidden secrets about Canadian prime ministers. Now, we've heard a lot about the trust fund kid last week, Justin Trudeau, having been caught out on at least three occasions, but probably more, wearing brown face or black face. Well, there was a huge kerfuffle. now, in a healthy society, if it had been me, if I'd ever dressed up in blackface, and I never have, but if I had, I would have said, I meant no harm by it. It was not an insult to blacks or browns, and I've moved on. However, when you subscribe to cultural Marxist nonsense, what Justin Trudeau did nearly 20 years ago was wrong. Wrong by his morality, not mine. And of course, that makes him a hypocrite. Anyway, I found this article very interesting. It says here, on a Tuesday just before Easter 1977, René Math, a National Social Credit Member of Parliament, rose in the House of Commons and asked Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, that's Justin's father, whether he had ever been a militant member of a secret separatist movement. Mr. Trudeau shrugged, Liberals shouted shame, and a Tory MP shouted that Mr. Trudeau had nodded yes. The Speaker saw Mr. Trudeau's head nod and let the comment stand. Unfortunately, that very interesting challenge went down the memory hole. Journalists missed the moment. Mr. Trudeau, therefore, was not compelled to come to terms with the anti-Semitic play he wrote while at Brebeuf College or with his bitter opposition to the Second World War, at least initially. When he associated with a group of separatists who stocked guns for a revolutionary uprising, his memoirs are completely silent on his separatist and militant past, and someone might also say, a decade later, his pro-communist past. In fact, he was pro-Red China and pro-Castro all of his adult life, let's say after about 1950. In fact, one of the few foreign dignitaries who attended Pierre Trudeau's funeral was, that's right, Fidel Castro. So Pierre Trudeau, moved from one side of the political spectrum to another. And fair enough, people change their minds. Many knew, but they kept their silence. On his last day in Parliament in 1984, Mr. Trudeau and Brian Mulroney jousted over Mr. Mulroney's call for the government to apologize to Japanese Canadians for their internment during World War II. Trudeau asked, where would it end? With so many historical grievances and so many crimes against the peoples who came together to create the Canadian nation. Mr. Trudeau argued that the past was a source of conflict and divisions that the present could neither fully know nor arrogantly judge it. And for once, I believe Pierre Trudeau was right. He cautioned against an apology to the Japanese who'd been interned. Many minorities in other countries weren't just interned, they were massacred. And Trudeau was right. You can never completely judge the past from the perspective of the present. What you can do is try to do justice in the present. Just as he would not have wanted to be judged on what he had so wrongly done and believed in 1941, neither should we cavalierly judge others. Well, I'm not so sure he was wrong in 1941, not wanting to participate in a very bad war. He would later change his mind, but and here's another very interesting historical fact. In writing biographies of Pierre Trudeau and Lester Pearson, I was echoing Calgary Mayor Naheed Nimshi's description of his reaction to the younger Trudeau in blackface, sucker punched. In the case of Pierre, there was his confused but unmistakable anti-Semitism in the 1930s and foolish participation in violent separatist and anti-war groups in the 1940s. Well, there may be a significant reason for criticism of Jews, and there's a very valid reason to oppose participation in the Second World War. Well, here's another very fascinating fact. In the case of Lester Pearson, he was the prime minister from 63 to 68. His memoirs told a good war story, even an amusing one, about how he was hit by a bus and sent home before he could take on the Red Baron. Of course, that was Baron Manfred von Richthofen. One day, reading a 1918 copy of the Guelph Mercury, I discovered that Mr. Pearson's parents welcomed home their son, who had suffered a failure of nerves. Not that he'd been injured by being hit by a bus. A curious Pearson family allowed me to examine Mr. Pearson's medical records. His condition became clear. He suffered from what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder, but what many then called cowardice. The reports indicated he stuttered, shook, slept constantly, and was unable to fight. Even when he wrote his memoirs in the 1970s, he kept his silence, and he never told his family. Had Canadians known in 1957, when they first elected Lester Pearson, of Pearson's wartime problems, it's doubtful he would have become, according to a policy options poll of journalists and academics, Canada's best post-war prime minister. If information on Pierre's earlier beliefs had become widely known in 1968 as he campaigned for the Liberal leadership, Robert Wilson Winters, a unilingual Nova Scotia businessman, would have become Liberal leader and prime minister. A very, very interesting point in that article. The press's lack of curiosity, or in some places outright complicity, prevented people from knowing the truth. Lester Pearson had roughly a nervous breakdown. At that time it would have been called cowardice. Today we might be more compassionate, I don't know. But he was not a great warrior, brave warrior in World War I, and he was not sidelined, as he lyingly told people, or jestingly told people, because he'd been hit by a bus. He'd simply gone into a funk and then been shipped home. I think, from the point of view of 1957, many people would have thought he's not fit to be a leader. And there was considerable reason to believe he was a Soviet agent of influence. And there's a book written by a great University of Toronto scholar who made a convincing case for that. And who was it who brought in a person who was by then a pro-communist Quebec radical, no longer anti-war, that was a decade or two before, a pro-communist obscure Quebec academic, Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Who was that? Lester Pearson. Interestingly, in 1965, when Pearson was being pressed by the Jewish lobby to bring in anti-free speech hate legislation to cover his butt, he struck a Royal Commission on Hate Propaganda. Now, you can control the results of such a Royal Commission by, that's right, whom you appoint. Whom did he appoint? Well, to a seven-person commission, he appointed Dean Maxwell Cohen. That's the Dean of Law at McGill University, who just happened to be former president of the Canadian Jewish Congress. Right. And Saul Hayes, who just happened to be, you guessed it, a former president of the Canadian Jewish Congress. Jews constituted, at that time, a little over 1% of the Canadian population. So there's two Jews on a seven-person panel, and they're wildly overrepresented. Who was another member of that Royal Commission? That's right, an obscure leftist professor from Quebec, Pierre Elliott Trudeau. And don't you think the Jewish lobby didn't have something on him, right? They knew about his wartime activities, the early wartime activities, when at one point, being a smart ass, he drove around Montreal on a motorcycle with parts of a Nazi uniform. Now, you can say that's right or wrong, but let's say that would not have gone down well politically when he was trying to become Prime Minister of Canada in 1968. Don't kid yourself. People had the dirt on him. And being an ambitious man, I'm sure when he was confronted with what they had on him, he decided to vote the right way. And that's part of the reasons we got Canada's notorious hate law a few years later in 1971. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. I'm going to take my musical break right now, and I'm going to play a few songs by Merle Haggard. And here's one of the great ones, Daddy Frank. Daddy Frank, the guitar man, was blind. Kind of a real touching song. Hope you like it. I think we've got another ad we've got to suppress, and we'll get to Daddy Frank, the guitar man was blind.
Daddy Frank played the guitar and the French harp, and sister played the ringing tambourine, and mama couldn't hear our pretty music, but she read our lips and helped the family sing. That little band was all a part of living, and our only means of living at the time. And it wasn't like no normal family combo, 'cause Daddy Frank, the guitar man, was blind. Frank and Mama counted on each other. Their one and only weakness made them strong. Mama did the driving for the family, and Frank made a living with a song. Home was just to camp along the highway. Pick a bed was where we bedded down. Don't ever once remember going hungry, but I remember Mama cooking on the ground. Daddy Frank played the guitar and the French harp. Sister played the ringing tambourine. Mama couldn't hear the pretty music, but she read our lips and helped the family sing. That little band was all part of living, and our only means of living at the time. And it wasn't like no normal family combo, 'cause Daddy Frank, the guitar man, was blind. Don't remember how they got acquainted. I can't recall just how it came to be, but there had to be some special help from someone, and blessed be the one who let it be. Fever caused my mom's loss of hearing. Daddy Frank was born without his sight, and Mama needed someone she could lean on. And I believe the guitar man was right. Daddy Frank played the guitar and the French harp. Sister played the ringing tambourine. Mama couldn't hear the pretty music. She read our lips and helped the family sing. That little band was all a part of living.
Shaw Blucher, take control of your Wi-Fi.
I just want a spoiler-free evening.
Tablet off, movie on.
Thanks.
Your Wi-Fi, your rules. Shaw Blucher.
One, two, three, four. Things I learned in a hobo jungle were things they never taught me in a classroom. Well,
like where to find the handout while bombing through Chicago in the afternoon. Hey, I'm not bragging or complaining, I'm just talking to myself man to man. This old mental fat I'm chewing didn't take a lot of doing, but I take a lot of pride in what I am. I guess I grew up a loner. I don't remember ever having any folks around. But I keep thumbing through the phone books and looking for my daddy's name in every town. And I meet lots of friendly people, but I always wind up leaving on the land. Hey, where I've been or where I'm going didn't take a lot of knowing, but I take a lot of pride in what I am. I never travel in a hurry, 'cause I got nobody waiting for me anywhere. Home is anywhere I'm living, if it's sleeping on some vacant banks in City Square. Or if I'm working on some road gang, or just living off the side of our great land. I've never been nobody's idol, but at least I got a title, and I take a lot of pride in what I am. Never been nobody's idol, but at least I got a title, and I take a lot of pride in what I am. I take a lot of pride in what I am. I take a lot of pride in what I am.
That's Merle Haggard. Take a lot of pride in what I am. This is Paul Fromm, and I take a lot of pride in what I am here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Here's a song by Lacey J. Dalton and Crazy Blue Eyes.
Why do I fall for
those crazy blue eyes.
Crazy blue eyes.
This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with the game tomorrow. Same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. Thank you.